Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The electricity industry is the largest industry in the United States. It literally powers modern life. Yet, this system that we depend on so much to deliver electricity has become increasingly vulnerable to breakdown, and there are questions about how and whether we will be able to meet the growing need for electricity in this country. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking about how we might avoid major outages while at the same time supplying that need and also reducing any negative environmental impact associated with electric power generation. And our guest for the program this morning is Jason McKenzie. He is president of Pearl Street Incorporated. That's a consulting firm that he founded in 2000, focused on all aspects of electricity production and delivery. He has for now something like 25 years or more been researching and analyzing the technological, business, and regulatory issues in electricity production and delivery. His company has been involved in many businesses serving the industry, including an investment fund, an advisory service for companies raising capital, and a policy advocacy organization. And he's the author of a book that explores many of these issues, so if you're interested, you can seek it out. His book is titled Lights Out, The Electricity Crisis, The Global Economy, and What It Means to You. That's the subtitle. It's published by Wiley, and I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore if you're interested in taking a look at it. As we talk in this hour of the show, of course, questions are welcome from people who are listening, and the only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so that we can keep moving along, get in as many people as possible. But certainly, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Now, we do also have a toll-free line, and that means that if it would be a long-distance call for you, we will pick up the call. We'll pay for it, and that's 800-222-9455. That's our toll-free line. Again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. McKenzie, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Just in as a way of starting, there are a number of kind of big general questions I want to ask, and then maybe we can go in and talk about things a little bit more specifically. But just as a general question, something I know that you address in the book, it's certainly true. We know that there is a good deal of discussion in the media about issues involving oil. And that's certainly a very important energy source, and we need it. And there are questions about how much of it there is and where it is and how we get it and how we meet our need. But having said all that, it seems surprising that given the importance of electricity and how much of that we use and how important that is, how our economy relies on it, it seems that within the media, there's not a lot of discussion. There's not a lot written about the issues of electricity, how we produce it, how we distribute it, how we meet the need, and potential vulnerabilities of the system. Why do you think it is that we seem to, at least to date, have paid so little attention to these issues?
Well, probably the largest reason is oil is a geopolitical has geopolitical implications and is a global commodity. Electricity, as viewed by ratepayers, citizens, voters, is much more parochial. You have an electricity meter on your home or business. You pay a bill every month, and you just sort of expect a local utility, quote unquote, to take care of your problems. What people don't understand is that your electricity infrastructure, number one, is becoming more subjected to the vagaries of geopolitical issues, the system just wasn't built in the way that it's being used today.
Mm-hmm. There, within the last decade, I suppose, roughly speaking, there has been a big change in the way that electricity is produced and delivered. In this sense, the old model was that a utility company operated all of the aspects of the system. That is, they had the power plant that generated the electricity. The wiring that got it from there to your house belonged to the utility company. They were responsible for maintaining the lines. They did everything, the building, the maintenance, the whole deal. And they operated within a particular geographic area. And if you happened to live in that area, that was your power company. Well, mm-hmm. the things have changed significantly because there is now at least the possibility of having some choice where you get your power from. And the other thing is that the system itself that has been broken up. So we had now, instead of it all being one system, we have pieces. There's a production piece. There's a distribution piece. And we don't have these monolithic companies anymore that do everything. They're somewhat broken up. So maybe the one question would be, Why did we do that? In whose interest did we do that? And what did the power companies get out of it? And what, if anything, did consumers get out of it?
Well, what you describe there is what I call and have been calling for about 5 to 10 years the quasi-deregulatory quagmire that the electricity industry finds itself in. The upshot is that some parts of the production and delivery value chain, which is, you know, what I define as taking an energy source, whether it's a wind or a lump of coal or a drop of oil, and converting that into electricity, then transmitting that electricity long distances, distributing it to ratepayers, and then how that electricity is used. And some parts of that system have been disaggregated and subjected to competition, and some parts have not. And in fact, there's actually more of a re-regulatory trend today. What do the utilities get out of it? Well, regulated utilities still get out of it what they've always gotten out of it, and that is that they invest money to provide service, and they get a regulated rate of return on that investment. And that's the simple end of the story. And I think people always need to understand that for all the rhetoric and talk and discussion and debate, a regulated utility doesn't really care what it spends its money on as long as it gets a regulated rate of return. Now, the other parts of the system, you have generating companies that have been disaggregated, and about 40% of the ability to generate electricity at power plants in this country is now deregulated and subjected to some form of competition. So in other words, if that plant wants to sell its product into the market, it has to bid into the market and define the price that it's going to sell at. Unfortunately, when you have pieces of it that are very regulated and pieces of it that are deregulated, you create all kinds of unneeded constraints. It's true, 15 years ago we had a completely monolithic system. One utility pretty much took care of the whole thing from soup to nuts. Today we have a real institutional mess, and what I find is that we create more institutions and more organizations, and we're not doing anything about actually fixing the infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to stay with the subject of deregulation here, and perhaps talk specifically about the experience here in the state of Illinois. And I'm sure that there are other places where the experience has been similar. And I think that you're at least somewhat familiar with the story here in Illinois. It's been a big story here over the past few months. Going back about 10 years or so, the legislature passed legislation that they called utility deregulation, although, as you point out, and I think a lot of people would point out, that it really wasn't. And the argument was that by giving people, introducing competition in and giving people a choice among power suppliers, that competition would lead to lower rates. It seemed that certainly the utilities must have been interested in having this happen. Some of the very big users of power were interested in having it happen. And it seemed like they both, the utilities and the big commercial users, actually did realize some benefit, but that for regular consumers there hasn't been, and it's argued the reason that hasn't happened is that the legislature, in order to get this thing passed, put a cap on rates, so they were kept artificially low for a long time. The cap comes up, the rates jump up. Citizens of Illinois are unhappy. The legislature says, "Okay, we got to do something about this because we can't have the people unhappy like this." And so the legislature has passed something which has yet to be signed by the governor. Why was it that this promise that was made to your average utility customers, residential users now 10 years ago, that there would be competition and that they would see lower rates. Why is it that just didn't work out?
Well, there's a number of reasons. That's a very complicated answer. In Illinois, the reason why this was done was Illinois at that time had some of the highest electricity rates in the country. And, one of the reasons for that is it has a higher component of nuclear generation, and those nuclear plants were subjected to all the massive cost overruns that occurred during the construction phases, and particularly post Three Mile Island. What they did wrong, well, they did a number of things wrong, but one thing they did wrong was to mandate a rate reduction for certain classes of customers, particularly residentials, during this deregulatory phase. I consider that, throwing candy to the masses, because it was kind of a sop to say, hey, deregulation is already working. Your rates are lower, or at least they're stabilized. They haven't gone up. And I should add, and everybody who pays a rate in Illinois, and that's all of us, should know that the rate increases that they're suffering from right now don't even have anything to do with actually fixing things and building things into the future. It's mostly just to make up for this 10 years of not being able to raise rates and recover money. So, that's one issue there. The other thing that people get confused about is when the deregulatory and competitive proponents got this whole ball rolling, they talked about lower rates, but what they really meant was lower average rates for everybody, a rate that's lower on average for everybody. And, that means some bad things for consumers who may pay a little bit larger, higher rate. But also, if you have lower electricity rates to residentials and, to industrials and commercials, that's a job creation mechanism, because a lot of industries are very electricity intensive, and to have a reasonable rate is one thing people look at when they're deciding where to locate new businesses. So, there's the one hand of, I'm paying a higher rate, but there's the other hand of, the lower rates to somebody who uses a lot of electricity might actually benefit our region or our community. So the story is much broader and much more complex than people make it out, but the bottom line is that no matter who has deregulated their electricity system in this country, they continue to tamper with it, they continue to re-regulate it, and we still have this sort of situation in the middle where we just don't know who's responsible for a lot of parts of the system. Illinois, for example, is creating this new Illinois Power Agency that's going to do the auctioning and bidding for power. I just don't see how that's going to help anybody in the long run, that a government entity is going to be running the show. Now, would the utilities themselves do any better? I'm not sure, but California tried this 8 years ago, and it turned into a disaster.
When at the beginning of the year, when it became painfully obvious that a lot of people were going to be paying a lot more for their electricity, the legislature felt that they had to make some kind of response. And so one of the things that some people suggested was that they should put the rate cap back on. And I think at the same time, a lot of people said, well, that really doesn't make any sense, because then when it comes off again, we're going to be just where we are now. But in any case, the response of the power companies was, they said, well, if you do that, we're going to go bankrupt. Was there, in fact, some justification to that? Would it have been that bad for the power companies if the cap was put back on for another couple of years?
I probably couldn't comment on, what a specific utility's balance sheet looks like, but I can say that, these problems occurred in California, and the utilities did indeed go bankrupt there. Now, going bankrupt is kind of a melodramatic thing. It could mean we're going bankrupt immediately, or it could mean that, 5 to 10 years from now, because of all the other things we're going to have to do, this trend is going to set us on a course towards bankruptcy. You know, I'm not clear what they meant, but it certainly was clear to me that the utilities would be in serious financial trouble. After, but number one, by having 10 years of not being able to raise rates and, you know, get some you know, money in return for, you know, investment and continuing operations, and, you know, all the things that they have to do going forward. So, you know, that's one issue. The other issue from the consumer point of view, and I always like to point out, and I do this in my book, Lights Out, that the you know, there is the consumer responsibility, and then there is the service provider responsibility. You know, the consumer, I think, had to realize that we, you know, they had 10 years of rate stabilization or rate reduction, and at some point, you know, their rates were going to go up. Now, maybe it was dumb to, you know, have a very large rate increase so suddenly, but the fact of the matter is that if you look at it over a 12-year period, they're still paying, you know, their rates are not so bad. And number two, you know, the fraction that a typical residential payer pays for electricity on their household budget is very small. I mean, on a national average, it's about 2.7%. So we still pay very little money. We make very little personal investment into this product that is fundamental to our way of life. That's kind of the point that I try to make in this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, just one more question, and I have a couple of callers we'll get to. The story that we've been discussing here, what happened here in Illinois with what was called deregulation, where the idea was to allow competition that was supposed to be good for consumers for a period of time, though rates were frozen, and then the rates come off. The cap comes up, the rates jump up, then people start talking about re-regulating. We've seen this same story played out in a very similar way in other states as well. So this is not just something that's happened in Illinois; it's happened a lot of other places. That's right.
Yes, it's you know, the most egregious example is Texas, but essentially this is occurring all over the country. You know, just about all of the areas that. That had an accelerated program for deregulation and competition have now sort of turned back the clock at, you know, some cases a little bit and some cases a lot. But certainly the bottom line is that we are not on a path towards competition in electricity supply today in this country.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Jason McKansey. He has been researching and analyzing technological, business, and regulatory issues in electricity production and delivery for over 25 years now. He's president of Pearl Street Incorporated. It's a consulting firm that he founded that focuses on all aspects of electricity production and delivery. He is also the author of a book that explores a lot of these issues. You might be interested in looking at it. His book is titled Lights Out, The Electricity Crisis, The Global Economy, and What It Means to You. It's published by Wiley and is in bookstores now. Questions, comments are certainly welcome from people who are listening. In fact, we have several ready to go. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we'll start out here with someone locally here in Champaign-Urbana, and that is line one. Hello.
Hi, discuss auctions. Why would there be a difference in bid versus ask prices, and also discuss a few summers ago the power grid that went out east due to a tree branch hitting a line. Like, is there a policy in place where some customers would get full power and others would get nothing, or would everyone get low power, which is okay for electric bulb to run on, but some appliances don't run on low power?
Two big questions, and maybe we can save the grid question for a little bit, but I would be interested in having you talk about this power auction thing, because it's something that I'm not sure that I understand. I don't think a lot of people understand that.
I frankly am not sure that I understand the whole power auction thing. I think the question was, you know, how would that be able to lower prices? And you know, I think the theoretical aspects of competition, you know, where you know one supplier has let's say much lower cost generating facilities and can bring power in, say, from or can bring power in from a low cost region, they can auction in a lower price. Now, I think what the caller is alluding to is the fact that everybody is using the same infrastructure to bring this power in. So where are the savings? And that's a very good question. Originally, as we were going to impose competition on a regional and national level, it actually made a lot of sense to me because let's just take Illinois for an example. There's very low cost coal-fired generation in the southern part of the state, and the ability to put in more low cost coal-fired generation right at the mines, and ship that power up to big load centers like Chicago. Now, originally competition was meant to prompt those kinds of actions on the part of the market players. Most of that didn't happen because we have other constraints in the system that were not completely deregulated. It was still very difficult for, let's say, a generator with low-cost power somewhere else to get the rights and the permission that they, were required by law to negotiate with the utility. It still became difficult to get all those pieces in place to bring that lower-cost power to a customer. So, in fact, the caller has a legitimate question. Where were the costs going to be extracted out of the system? And as the deregulatory system evolved, there probably wasn't a lot of cost that could be extracted.
Well, the thing that I guess, again, maybe people have a tough time with is the notion that it goes back to this idea that what was once a monolithic system has been broken up. The thing that's maybe a little bit confusing is that the company that you buy, that you're buying the power from, has to go out and buy it so that they can sell it to you, and that they have various ways of doing that. One thing that I think here has gotten a lot of attention is this idea of the reverse auction. And now, as part of this legislation that the General Assembly has passed, what they think that the power companies should do, they want to push them into signing much longer-term contracts that will lock in a price for the power that they're buying that then they're selling on, for a period of, I think, 5 years. So, and I guess the idea is that that's supposed to contain volatility and get a good price for them, and that means a good price for customers.
The original intention was for a ratepayer, you or I, to be able to go to one of a number of service providers and say, okay, who's giving me the lowest rate and the best service, and then you buy from them. That entity then aggregates all the people that selected them, and then goes out to the generation market and buys a block of power to serve those customers. Then that block of power is, generated, transmitted, and distributed for a fee by the utilities controlling those parts of the system. That was the original intent, was to give, quote-unquote, customer choice. But what's happened now is that we've gone back and said, okay, it wasn't very profitable to serve the individual ratepayers, and I think everybody pretty much knew that from the beginning. The load that these service providers want to serve are the big industrial and the big commercial loads. It's just like anything else. It's much easier to sell five megawatts to a commercial building than it is to sell 2 kilowatts to 500,000 people. Okay, it's just a lot of customers, a lot of billing, a lot of interaction, a lot of cost there. So, we've gone, Illinois is going back now and saying, okay, the state will now go buy power through an auction to provide through service providers to the to all these customers. And, frankly, I just see that Illinois is adding another entity, a government-owned and controlled one at that, injecting that into the process. So once again, another institutional layer, but no improvement on the basic physical infrastructure to get electricity from one place to another.
Okay. Our next caller is in Belgium, over by Danville. This is line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. It seems, I'm not sure if I can put this the way I'd like to put it, but it seems like the basic problem comes down to that the state governments are having real problems at trying to control electric rates through regulation. Why don't we try to do it in a little bit different way and save a whole lot of problems in that these people don't want to generate power for the small customer that takes just a few kilowatts. Then let those people generate it the way they can themselves and start putting their own grid in that they generate it on their sun, produce 12 volt, and then just run their house off 12 volt, which a lot of us can do. We'd save ourselves carbon pollution, and the state could start new industries and solving two problems, and they could still go on generating all the power they wanted for the very large companies.
The caller has an interesting solution there, and it was one that was pursued vigorously at the national level to allow what he's described and we call in the industry distributed generation, allowing farms, businesses, homes, buildings to generate their own electricity with small generating devices and then interconnect back in with the grid. Now, you know, there's several problems there that came up. One is that, you know, the national initiative lost favor in the Bush administration, and two, you know, the utility has already invested money and put infrastructure in to serve certain customers, and so the question was, you know, how do they get compensated for the assets that are no longer going to be used? But there was a trend to move that way, and as I describe in the book Lights Out, we're likely to have a resurgence in that trend to have local microgrids, we call them, with distributed generating devices, precisely because we're not doing anything about the transmission and distribution infrastructure to get electricity from one place to another. So I think the caller's vision is could happen naturally if we don't do something about supplying bulk power to customers.
No, sir, I think you missed a small part of my statement in that we need to move away from having the grid completely. A small generator would not be on the grid, not worry about tying in and getting in money back from the situation, just to produce enough power for himself and move on. Especially since, as you mentioned, these people don't really want to keep up this portion of the grid, so why should they be compensated for something that's already worn out?
Yeah, well,
the states should give tax rebates or something for people who are going to try to do this. Is see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, you're talking about off-grid power. Maybe I misinterpreted.
Yes.
What you were saying, and that's fine for people who understand and can run machinery that way. That is vital to their way of life. I don't have any argument with that at all. I just think the vast majority of residences and homeowners and businesses, you know, don't have the wherewithal, nor do they want that much responsibility for their electricity future.
No, sir. What I'm also pointing is we start an entire new industry, sir, that generates technicians that know how to put these things in, and they are self-operating. You buy it just like you buy a furnace.
Yeah, just like an appliance.
Exactly.
Right. And, again, I don't have any argument with that if the infrastructure is in place and customers, you know, are willing to go, you know, with that paradigm. I mean, it really doesn't matter. I suspect what happens is that, there's a lot of differentiation then between, you know, one electricity, one home or one person's electricity and somebody else's, which is fine. Maybe somebody can do with one level of supply and service and voltage, and somebody else makes do with another. I mean, that would provide, I agree, the ultimate in customer choice.
Thank you very much.
All right. But just the basic idea here, whether it is the idea that there are some people who could actually be, as far as their electricity was concerned, self-sufficient, or people who would do some generating of their own electricity. So maybe there are times when they in their home could generate the electricity they use. There might be times when they would need to buy a little bit because they couldn't meet the need. There might be times when they would generate more than they could use. So there's this concept of reverse metering that might come into being. All of those sorts of things. There's no reason why that couldn't happen. There might be technical issues. There might be regulatory issues. There might be all kinds of issues that have to get worked out. But that is as an idea, that's perfectly doable. If we decided
let's face it, we don't have a utility that provides us a computer, right? We all go out, we buy our own computers, we make our own choices, we build our own systems in our homes, and businesses, experts build them for businesses. But I might remind the caller that the internet, on which now everybody's computer systems are based, is run by a centralized authority. Okay, so that's gone from a distributed model and moving back towards almost a centralized model. Now, for electricity, it's true. You could run a campaign and say every ratepayer should be off the grid and be responsible for their own electricity. Now, number one, if that took off and there was a huge infrastructure and products and technicians and things in place, then I think you could even get the costs below, what a utility would provide. Although I suspect that the reason we ended up with the system that we did, very centralized and, moving power long distances, is because there are lots, when you really get into it, there are lots of problems in providing off-grid power at a level of service and reliability that everybody has come to expect. Now, if we did that today, if the caller, had his wish and we did that today, the least expensive way to generate that electricity would be an engine generator set using fuel. Okay? Now, I think personally from an environmental point of view, it's a lot easier to beat up on the big utility with the big coal fire plant and get them to reduce emissions than to ask a million people with an engine generator to put a catalytic device on that engine and reduce their NOx emissions. So there are trade-offs in all these things. There are no free lunches anywhere. And, the ultimate cost is what will drive any sort of paradigm, even the one the caller is suggesting.
Let's talk with another caller. Have someone here in Urbana, where we are, line number two. Hello.
Yes. A question about the Illinois power situation, Ameren today. It seems to me it's a bit of a farce. As I understand it, the holding company that owns both the distribution and the generation facilities that used to be Illinois Power is the same entity, and that while they might be losing money on the distribution, they were still making a great deal of money on the generation. Is that true?
Again, I don't profess to be an expert on, individual utilities' balance sheets. It would be up to, somebody else to say that. My book and, most of the work that I do, takes a much less parochial view of the electricity business. I can say in general that, and as I do point out in the book, is that, the generation part of the business became a very, a profitable part of the business if you could move low-cost generation into a high-cost area. And that, actually serving customers, and in particular serving residential customers, is very costly. And so there are dislocations through this, disaggregation of the generation, transmission, and distribution that have occurred. And it may be true that Ameren makes a lot of money on generation and can't make it on distribution, but it's not for me to pick apart their financial balance sheet.
I have a more technical question on the transmission of power. Which is more efficient, to transmit power over lines great distances or to move the coal to a nearby facility and generate it within a close range of the final market?
Well, it's always been my opinion and the evaluations that I've seen that it is least the least cost approach is to generate electricity and distribute what we call in the industry coal by wire. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always been an advocate of, you know, if you're going to build a coal-fired power plant, you should build it at the mine, and have a mine mouth plant, reduce the costs and burdens of long distance rail transport, and then ship the electricity from that facility to the load centers. Now you do lose some in transmission if you have a 500 to 1,000 mile transmission line AC. You're likely to lose, you know, up to 10%, maybe more, of that energy. But still, you know, overall, it's cleaner and more efficient to do it that way. Although I'm sure the rail companies would have an evaluation that suggests otherwise.
But it definitely would not be efficient to do what they did at Milwaukee, where they located the generation facility, I believe, up at Iron Mountain, and then shipped the fuel on the additional distance, and then moved the electricity back to Milwaukee. That kind of thing is, it seems to me, the height of irresponsibility.
I guess depending on where that's located. I mean, I would imagine...
Well, it's about 500 miles from Milwaukee.
If it's not on a mine and you're saving part of the transportation, that doesn't seem the best location for a plant.
And no, actually, you'd be increasing the transportation because I imagine the coal is either coming from out west or from Illinois.
I'm pretty sure it's coming from Wyoming.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
So it'd be a neutral.
We're about 10 minutes left here in this part of Focus 580. Let me again very quickly introduce our guest, Jason McKenzie. He is someone who has been doing research and analysis on the technological, business, and regulatory issues in electricity production and delivery for a number of years now. He has a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from Columbia University. He's the president of Pearl Street Incorporated. That's a consulting firm that he founded in 2000 that focuses on all aspects of electricity production and delivery. He's the author of a book that explores a lot of these issues, so if you'd like to take a look at it and read more, you should look for the book. The title is Lights Out, The Electricity Crisis, The Global Economy, and What It Means to You, published by Wiley. Just for a second here, before we go on to other callers, to go back to a question an earlier caller raised, I think people still will remember this major outage that happened in the Northeast some years ago that was traced to a problem with the wires, essentially. I think that there is certainly concern about the distribution system, its age, whether it is able to handle the increasing load that's put on it because demand for power continues to go up. And I think that a lot of people say that would suggest that accident that led to that outage that we saw is that we shouldn't be surprised if we see that happening more and more because the money just hasn't been put into maintaining that system, that distribution system. What can you say about the system, its condition, and its vulnerability to that kind of problem here in the future?
Well, first of all, it is happening all across the country now. You know, it's not something that just happened in the in the Northeast. Now, you know, the root of the problem of the blackout of 203 is now sort of a celebrated root cause analysis, and you know, this branch fell on this major line, and that was, you know, that's sort of what people remember. Whether the part that I would like to get people focused on is not that a failure occurs. You know, we will always have failures and inadequacies in how we operate, maintain, you know, distribution systems, you know, transmission systems, generating systems. But, you know, that branch fell, it wasn't a branch that fell, but it was a tree trimming, lack of tree trimming episode. How that failure propagates through the system is what's important. And, you know, what we don't have in the vast majority of the grid in this country is a way to monitor things like that and prevent the cascade from moving on down and on through the region and throughout the grid. And we have technology and we have products and systems that can do that job for us. And, you know, one of the issues I get into in this book is that we're not spending money on these things. You know, we're having rate increases because of all this institutional and financial engineering that one of the callers rightfully alluded to with the buying and selling of assets here in Illinois. But we're not spending the money on physical needs, physical infrastructure. So, you know, the outages that we had here in St. Louis the past 2 years in the winter and summer, you know, yeah, it's the same thing. It's the root cause analysis is that, you know, there were icy limbs and these limbs fall during storms, you know, in the wrong places. All that's fine and well, but, you know, how do these things cascade throughout the system? And, you know, are there ways to monitor that, prevent that, throw a switch here, you know, get a substation, you know, off on an emergency basis there and bring it back on in 2 minutes so that one doesn't cascade as well? You know, these are all the real issues in the electricity system in this country, and I haven't even gotten into, you know, things like global warming and all these new cost pressures, but the public, you know, the listeners of this station need to understand all of these things will be affecting the electricity price in the future. I mean, what we've seen so far in Illinois and the rest of the country is mild compared to what's going to happen, or at least that's my informed comment on pricing and the reliability. We're not paying yet for the things we need to pay for.
All right. We have several callers here. We'll try to get them all in the time that is left. The next is in Urbana in line one. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. Back in the late 70s, I was doing some grad work in economics, and at that time, it was such a, quote, hot topic, electrical regulation, and there were just tons of people working on it throughout the country. There was, you know, journals on utility regulation. What is so hard about it that after it's almost 30 years now, that they don't have a better grasp of what's going on? I mean, I think that our state was talking about needing more time to decide and figure out what the regulations were doing and stuff, and it was just it just kind of, I don't understand what is so complicated about it that they can't come up with better ideas or better understandings.
Well, here's two things. First, electricity is a unique product in that it can't be stored as electricity. Okay, you can store it as energy in another form, but by and large, we don't have much capability to store electricity. Therefore, the entire grid is what we call a just-in-time inventory system. You know, an electron that's put in the grid at a generating station has to be taken out at a customer site or used for the system to maintain its balance. So that's one thing that makes the economic evaluations look a little funny. The other thing is that where you put generating assets, and this is one of the reasons why the system, the utility industry, became monolithic in the beginning, in the early part of the last century, is that if you put a generating device in one part of the grid, then it affects the transmission and distribution characteristics of all other parts of the grid. So, you know, economists, you know, talk about the use of nodes, you know, locational marginal pricing at a particular node in the system. Well, that's all fine, but that's a real-time node, and if you put a generating plant, let's say 2 miles from that node, then those economic characteristics at that node change. And so people have not, you know, it's just a different kind of system from other products and services that are more amenable to competition.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Let's go to another caller, and this is Chicago, line four on the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, thanks. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think the listeners have a pretty good idea what's going on, and maybe not technically as that much, but I think pretty much we understand that the system's being gained to make maybe what we most average person would consider unreasonable profits, and that expense of any of the things you were talking about, infrastructure, maintenance, and such. My understanding of what one of the previous callers was asking about is that what Commonwealth Edison has done is peeled off their most profitable section into Exelon, mostly their nuclear power plants, and they're now claiming that they should be able to sell the electricity from those plants, and those plants are very profitable now because the average price of electricity is, for coal and natural gas has gone up so much, it now makes nuclear very profitable because the costs of nuclear have not gone up. And they now want to say they want to sell that on the open market, which really doesn't mean the open market. Basically means sell it back to us through Commonwealth Edison's distribution at a much higher price than they would have had they been kept part of Commonwealth Edison. And, you know, this is stuff we paid for a long time ago, and now they basically are going to gouge us on it when, hey, we've got these nuclear power plants. They're producing cheap electricity for us now. Why shouldn't we benefit from that? No, we're going to sell it to you at market rate, the same rate that we would pay if it was natural gas or coal. That's my understanding of what's going on with that.
I didn't detect a question in there, but...
Well, it wasn't really.
I mean, I'd be happy to address it. You're right in the sense that Exelon has a lot of nuclear generation, and nuclear generation does tend to be inexpensive compared to the other forms today. I think one of the things you would have to look at is, you know, how much of that generation is actually sold, you know, on a wholesale basis to a customer, and you know, are they, you know, how much money are they making on that, and how much, you know, would they really make by, you know, selling that to their subsidiary Commonwealth Edison, the distribution entity. I mean, the fact is that there are, whether they work well or not, there are safeguards in place so that this sort of double dealing or intra-dealing within the utility does not or cannot occur.
Do you? I guess that there is certainly the question. I think a lot of people ask the question is, and perhaps it's one that that sort of depends on your perspective about the level of profit that the utility companies are making, whether or not it's adequate, exorbitant. Can you make judgments like that?
That's a very difficult judgment to make. I guess the way I would put it is that the utilities are making more money through financial engineering and moving assets around and buying and selling assets and, you know, trying to get around some of these rules or guidelines, whatever they are, within states to, you know, sell here but not sell there and protect this customer, but you know that customer floats, you know, with the market rate. The fact is, they are making a lot of money doing that. What they should be making money on, and they're not today, is by investing in the infrastructure and getting a return on that investment. And I, you know, that's the part that worries me.
Let's take one more caller here in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Yeah, I just wonder, in terms of a comment, how much mistrust was generated as a result of Enron? You know, you mentioned California and all that, but do you think this had an impact or not?
Oh, I think it has a great impact, even though, you know, Enron imploded, 6 years ago now, and Ken Lay actually died of a heart attack, and, you know, that you'd think that chapter was closed, but I think the whole Enron, and by the way, you know, I don't bash just Enron. You know, there are plenty of other people who do a good job of that. But fact of the matter is that the entire merchant power and independent side of the business and electricity trading companies were all doing the same thing. I mean, and they were being encouraged to do the same thing by the fervor on Wall Street at the time. So, you know, it was endemic to the to those aspects of the industry. Enron was just the leader and the most egregious example. But certainly, you know, the hangover from Enron has created a lot of mistrust. But the fact of the matter is that what Enron was doing is not what people should be worried about today regarding their electricity rates or what utilities appear to be up to.
Yeah. Just as a way of finishing up here, we have about a minute or so left. Just again, and going back to what an earlier caller suggested, certainly there is a possibility for people to generate some of their own power. Certainly we can realize significant kinds of savings in terms of our need for power by greater efficiency. But at the same time, we know that there's still going to be a tremendous demand for delivered electricity. Do you think that in the future we're going to have a difficult time That is, the industry will have a difficult time meeting that need, or that people will have a difficult time getting the power that they need at a reasonable cost.
I think we were that really is one of the overarching points of the book, that it takes so long to invest in a part of the infrastructure. I'll just give you an example. I was just reading before we got on this call, a large coal-fired plant down in southern Illinois. The development for this project started in year 2000. You know, we're year 2007, and we haven't put a shovel in the ground for that project. It's a very clean coal plant. I think it's a good neighbor. It's something that the state needs to have and would help the system, but we haven't put a shovel into that ground in 7 years, and they've just gotten approval from the Illinois Commerce Commission to build the transmission line that's going to be required to move that power. So, because these things take so long, and the callers, the listeners, even our industry are so fixated by these institutional issues, nobody's getting the real point, and that is that our prices are going to go up and our service is going to drop if we don't start investing in the total infrastructure.
Well, there we will have to leave it. Again, for people who are interested in reading more on the subject, you can look for the book that we have mentioned. The title of the book is Lights Out, The Electricity Crisis, The Global Economy, and What It Means to You, by our guest, Jason McKenzie. He is president of Pearl Street Incorporated. That's a consulting firm that he founded back in 2000. They look at all aspects of energy production and delivery. They do, in fact, have a website, so if you're interested in finding out more about Pearl Street, it's pearlstreetinc.com. Mr. McKenzie, thanks very much.
Thank you, David. Appreciate the opportunity.